Hi everyone, this is Austin welcoming you to the LL Research Radio program In the Now, Q&A with Carla and crew. Today is Tuesday, October 14th, 2014. Carla L. Ruckert is an author, mystic, seeker, and primary channel for LL Research. The crew in the title refers to those of us at the LL Center, beginning with Jim McCarty, Carla's husband, scribe for The Raw Contact, and president of LL Research. Gary and I, devoted seekers of the Law of One, manage LL from the home office. LL Research is a nonprofit organization dedicated to freely sharing spiritually oriented information and fostering community, and towards this end has two websites, the archive website llresearch.org and the community website bringforth.org. Together they offer over 1,300 channeling transcripts, 11 publications, the Law of One material, interviews, speeches, forums, blogs, chat rooms, and more. We will be discussing questions that come from you. If you would like to ask us a question live on the air, please call 646-595-2294 and press the 1 key when prompted. Again, that number is 646-595-2294. If interested in submitting a question when we're not on the air, please visit our show's webpage at blogtalkradio.com/LLresearch. When submitting questions, please remember that this is a Law of One Q&A. Try to keep your questions as spiritually oriented as possible. Again, I'm Austin, and we're talking with Carla L. Ruckert and the home crew of LL Research. Is everybody with us and ready to go?
We are.
I am indeed.
All righty. First up is our opening riff, which comes from a Kuo session on September 15th, 1996. Kuo says, "We encourage each, when thinking about the right use of time, to remember to consider, before all else, whether the self is tuned to match the vibration of love. Each feels this constant within. Move into the heart. Move the attention into that place within that is the metaphysical equivalent of the heart, the green ray energy center. Here is the seat of love coming into the created body. Here is that holy of holies where love dwells fully, undistorted and pure. Moving into this sacred place within, open the heart and feel the love of the one infinite creator. Thus, one can finish an incarnation and only then realize that one has run out of time for that which one has come to do. Yet that for which one took flesh is available to be done in every living moment."
Thank you, Austin. It just seems so hard to be in the heart, to stay in the heart, to live in the heart. It's more likely that you're ready to meet life with a growl. Because there's always one more thing to do and one more thing after that, and we feel crowded and busy. It goes on. You can see it in people's driving more than anything else, I think. You're out and you're driving, trying to get to the drugstore. To your sadness, you discover that everybody's trying to get somewhere faster than you. People are trying to cut you off. People are trying to tailgate you. People are trying to tell you you're just not going fast enough. And you can see it out the window happening up and down the lane if you're in traffic. It's kind of sad, you know. Kind of sad for all of us that we can let ourselves get so crowded that we give up, give in, and let something as small as the next thing we have to do keep us away from love. We don't have to. It only takes a second. It need only take a second to pray, "Come, Holy Spirit, fill the heart of your faithful. Kindle in me the fire of your love." You don't have to do it like that. That's just me. The idea is that you're inviting love which is who you are in actuality and in reality, to come into your heart, where it belongs, where it always was, where it always will be. So why is it so hard? I don't know. It's not hard for my cat. My cat wanted to come see me, and as I speak, she is purring and loving me and kneading on my chest, just telling me how much she's glad to be with me. And she's making us both feel wonderful. Thank you, Chloe. So there's one thing that the cat doesn't have, and that's the next thing to do, you know. It doesn't have an agenda. It doesn't have a schedule. Not unless it's hungry or unless it needs grooming. You know, it's happy. It's full of love. It's never separated from love. What keeps us from it are these little tiny events in our lives, our thoughts. It isn't the thing itself that keeps us from it. Never that. It's always our thoughts about the things, the next thing to do, the thing that's coming up tomorrow, the thing that you're worried about, the thing that happened yesterday that you still need to think about because you weren't happy with it, and on and on. And the thought machine, and the beat goes on, as Sonny Bono and Cher would say. Well, doggone it, can't we be like Sonny and Cher and the cat? We can, you know, we really can. It's like, I want to say, I'm a cheerleader. Rah, rah, rah. Come on, guys. You can do it. You can do it. But that's what it is. I mean, that's how obnoxious I'm being right now. I don't mean to nag. And I don't mean to be a cheerleader. It's just that it's so simple. If you're bollocksed, stop and take that moment and get back into your heart. If you're upset, if that next thing has got you by the tail, if all of those possibilities are occurring, stop. Creator to come back into your heart. He's waiting at the door patiently. So patiently. Come with me, folks. Come with me into that beautiful silence. It just takes a moment. And all the love. You don't want to keep yourself away from that. I know you don't. I love you all so much, and I know that many of you are worried. Many of you are feeling abandoned and lonely, isolated. You're just a heartbeat away from your own heart and from the love that is your nature and that will embrace your life and make of every breath a really beautiful thing. If you have to do it over and over again, it's still worth doing. Come with me, please. You will love it. All right. I pray that we all may dwell in that living seat of consciousness, and thus doing, may join all of humanity, all of the unseen worlds, and Chloe, my cat.
Thank you, Carla. And before we go to our questions for the day, Gary would like to say something.
Thanks, Austin. Thanks, Carla. We had a caller last week that got my own gears turning, and on a particular topic that I would like to offer a more long-form response to. I think I do better if I have some space to think about something rather than replying off the cuff. So I wanted to say that Ra called themselves messengers, messengers of the Law of One. Their message was about the ultimate nature of things, which is another way to say a message about who and what you are. About the ultimate nature of things, Ra said that it could not be put into words, only approximated by words. But Ra, nevertheless, utilized words and concepts. The words and concepts they chose to approximate the ultimate nature of things include perfect, whole, complete. They said also that all is well, nothing is lost, all is one, all is unified, infinite, things are infinite, things are eternal. So what do the words and concepts represent? Indeed, what is the function of the cosmology itself? In one word, I would say it constitutes a map. Ra's cosmology is not the terrain itself. It is only a map, and it's important to note one map among many, many other maps. It's the seeker who must exercise their discernment, find a map or three that works for them, and then use the map to discover, walk, and navigate the actual terrain for themselves. The seeker must test the map against their own experience and indeed form their own map in the process. Some maps are better than others, of course, and some maps suit different temperaments better than others. This is why each seeker is drawn to different philosophies or religions and worldviews. And there will probably never be a one-size-fits-all, in this density at least. Now, about Ra's particular map, we received a call to the show last week from a seeker who takes issue with certain aspects of that map, including Ra's use of the word perfect to describe the ultimate nature of things. This seeker felt that the word shouldn't be used because, in his mind, a seemingly evolving and changing illusion that seems to make so-called improvements is not, by definition, perfect. And this is where I would like to address paradox, because paradox is something that is unavoidable on the path of spiritual seeking, at least in this third density experience. And what's the greatest paradox? The paradox of the one and the many is the first that comes to my mind. How are things both one and many? How are things true? How is there illusion? Ra says that all is ultimately one, yet every conceivable piece of data that assaults our senses tells us precisely the opposite. And in the exploration of this paradox, one can amass infinite quantities of data to show and explain how things are not one. Indeed, the seeker can do that with any or all of the fundamental descriptions about reality. The seeker can look at the illusion and say that things are obviously fragmented and partial and divisible. Clearly, it is not, to use one of Ra's words, whole. The seeker can gaze at the physical realm and see that, obviously, things are always in a state of becoming and growing, rising and falling. How could this ongoing, ever-changing process be already, to use another of Ra's words, complete? The same seeker can look at the human state of affairs on this planet and reliably conclude that things are obviously not, to use another of Ra's words, well. And again, the seeker can look at everything they know about life itself and determine that there is obviously space and obviously time. Therefore, that seeker could understandably conclude that the true nature of things is clearly not infinite or eternal. Such a seeker can paint the most convincing picture that the mystical truth of unity is a fancy idea and nothing more. Indeed, such is the design of the veiled third density existence, to absolutely convince the entity of the reality of an individual self in a finite world of manyness. Yet, Ra says, not that one fine day things will be complete or whole or perfect, or that eventually the universe will be one, but rather, Ra says that things are already whole, complete, perfect, and one. No matter how things may seem to appear to our vision, no matter at what point we find our attention in the circuit of densities and octaves. This is the heart of paradox, to the best of my understanding. We have truths that seem completely contradictory to one another, that cannot possibly coexist, yet they do. Now, were Ra the sole voice in all of human history promulgating the position of a unified, love and light-filled, perfect reality, one might be less inclined to give Ra their ear. But the amazing thing here is that the mystical core of the Law of One's message has been with us on this planet in every age and from the most diverse corners of the globe, in all manner of religious, cultural, and historical backgrounds, in the form of what Aldous Huxley calls the perennial philosophy. From mystics of the European medieval period, to Kabbalists, to Middle Eastern and Persian Sufis, to the Hinduism of the Indian subcontinent, to Buddhism, to Chinese Taoists, to North and South American tribal mythology. A smarter person than I can make a better list. There have been those third density entities who have awakened to the ultimate nature of things from a multiplicity of starting points. And what do all these proponents of the perennial philosophy say? Each one who awakens has the same basic report to offer. There is only right now. Reality is infinite. It is ineffable and beyond the reach of our words. But if we are to employ those poor tools, then words such as perfect, whole, and complete are among the best we have to point to the actual nature of the situation. This is really the situation. All who have truly seen and experienced unanimously say to us from the seeming other shore, that there is only ever-ending perfection, no matter what seems to be happening on the surface. But genuine spirituality isn't about taking the mapmakers at their word, though their consistency and consensus across the ages does, in my mind, lend veracity to their report. Rather, genuine spirituality is about using the map and discovering the truth for yourself through the laboratory of the incarnation and through the portal of your own experience. Some of Ra's claims we cannot verify, say regarding whether the asteroid belt was once a planet that blew itself to smithereens. But we are in a position to discover and verify for ourselves whether reality is indeed unified, whole, complete, and perfect. Indeed, we are in that position because we are the reality, we are the truth, and we are already whole, complete, and perfect. But nobody can tell you that. You must find out for yourself. So while there is value in parsing out the meaning of words, because our beliefs about reality have an enormous influence on the paths we create, in the end we have to use words about reality only as metaphorical signs pointing to the ocean, and then, through will and faith alone, make our own way to the ocean. No sign can ever give us the actual experience of the ocean. We must dive into that mystery ourselves in order to know. And the Tao Te Ching could have said all that in a few sentences, but I'm a little bit longer. And that's it for me. Thanks for hearing me out.
Thank you, Gary.
Thank you, Gary.
All righty. Let's go to our questions sent in from seekers. Our first question comes from our friend JP via email. And JP asks, in the late summer of 1859, an event known to scientists as the Carrington event was the biggest solar flare event in recorded history. If that event were to happen in our modern times and current lifestyle, so much destruction and mayhem would result that it could collapse our society. The satellites, power grids, cell towers, and phone lines, internet, and most electronics, etc., would be severely disrupted for quite some time, and civil unrest would be quite likely worldwide. And that is not to mention the big asteroids, like the ones that took out the dinosaurs. I was under the impression that through the light and love and will of our local sub-logos and all form and harmony in the solar system, was to be kept in order, and creation and evolution were allowed to proceed and be expressed through its desired creation, to allow form to seeking elegance. When this did happen, and if it were to happen again, how or why would this be allowed, and cause our creation so much discomfort, chaos, and even death? What don't I get?
Well, I'll tell you, JP. I think that what you don't get is that the true nature of free will, the true nature of our situation, the true nature of the limitation of our unseen friend's ability to help us. Our situation has always been guarded. We as human beings are ridiculous. We're fragile. We couldn't make it through a winter. It may be that we couldn't make it through some summers without technology. We don't understand electricity or magnetism or the basic rules that we depend upon to make our little toys work so well. These tiny little agents of cleverness that do everything for us, almost. Not everything, but close to it. That's our situation. We are not being guarded from having terrible things happen to us. We are being guarded from our soul's dismantlement. That's the point at which, in the past, these energies have come in to save the souls that otherwise would have been lost to the Creator. This is an unacceptable loss. And so it is acceptable to the Creator that they preserve these souls until they find another body for them to live in. It's not the death that is guarded. It's the soul. A simple death is just a shift in consciousness. Consciousness was at this point in the vibrational, all the vibrations, whatever. And now it's in another place in that incredibly complex vibrational reality. And we work from there for a while until it becomes logical and desirable for us to take a body again. That is what is guarded. And that is the level from which it's guarded, the soul level. It is my understanding, and I could be wrong, and gentlemen, please correct me, that it is there and only there that they will jump in. We do not have standing by ready to save us from the disaster of our being killed by sickness or whatever. We do have saviors standing by to save our souls, to save their personality and structure, if you will. And that's very comforting. But that's not what you were expecting, JP, I know. I don't believe we can expect this from them. It is not their nature to be able to interfere with free will. We are the ones who can pray. we can ask those energies to move away from us, to have pity on us and not to do that to us. We can ask them again and again and let them know that we really do not want to be removed by such a terrible catastrophe. But remember, often it is not natural means that takes us out, but an enemy who sees how easy it is to create such a disaster and then creates it for their enemies. Gentlemen, please step in.
I agree with you that we're probably not going to have the most comforting answer that JP might be looking for. I've contemplated the same types of questions that JP is asking about whether or not a big asteroid would be allowed to wipe us out. And there's a only thing I can really think of as far as a mass death where it would kill everybody is it doesn't make much logical sense to me that in a universe that has the intelligence to create a system for life to evolve, that it would allow for a slip-up and let an asteroid just wipe out the entire life on a planet. But as far as the type of event that JP is talking about, like the Carrington event, where it's not necessarily a mass death, but more just a massive disruption. Before I respond to that, I feel compelled to mention that the creators and the maintainers of this type of infrastructure that JP is talking about are aware of this type of damage that can be done by solar flares, and they have systems in place to minimize the type of damage that would happen in that situation. I watched a really interesting documentary one time about organizations dedicated to monitoring solar flares and adapting our power grid to compensate for the surges of energy. And if this type of failsafe weren't in place already, then our energy grid would be getting knocked out on a pretty consistent basis. But I think that's a secondary point to what JP is really asking, but I wanted to make sure that JP knew that if the Carrington event happened today, it wouldn't necessarily be a massive disruption. It would probably be a pretty big disruption, but people are aware and, you know, they have systems in place to make sure it doesn't cause a complete failure of our infrastructure. So my main response to JP's main question is in that I think I have a little bit more faith in humanity than most people do, including JP, as JP talks about a lot of civil unrest. And I don't think that there would not be some unrest, but I think that we would handle it a lot better than a lot of people, probably a majority of people, would think that we would handle it. One of the most profound things that I learned in my childhood was from one of my childhood heroes, Mr. Rogers from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. It was a great children's program. He taught compassion and really a very green-ray individual. And one of the things that he said that stuck with me my entire life is when he was a young boy and he would see scary things and tragic disasters happening in the news, his mother told him to always look for the helpers and that there would always be helpers anywhere in an event, any kind of disaster, people helping and good people, good compassionate people trying to help other people who are in need. And I really think that that would happen if there were even a massive disruption of our infrastructure. I think that people would come together and help each other, and the helpers would be helping others, and the helpers would receive help, and there would probably be a lot of disharmony and a lot of suffering. But it would also be a very massive opportunity to serve. And I think that's another main point to respond to JP's question, is that this type of disharmony isn't necessarily going to disrupt the seeking of the positive polarity. And in a lot of ways, it can actually increase the potential to seek in the positive polarity. JP talks about how he believed that the sublogos would set up a system where our evolution would happen in complete harmony. But the sublogoi had a system of complete harmony before the veil, and not a whole lot happened. There wasn't a whole lot of seeking. And so some disharmony has to be introduced into the system in order to spur our seeking. And an event of this size, while it would probably be very uncomfortable for a lot of us, it would offer the opportunity for seeking, and probably in both polarities, not just positive polarity. I'm sure there would be some people who would seek in the other direction and take advantage of the situation to gain more power over other people. But ultimately, I think that it wouldn't be a disruption in our ability to seek, and could actually, even at this point in our evolution on Earth, help us to make one big push towards a positive polarity and come together and unite us as people. If every single person on Earth is suffering from some big event, then I think that that in a way would be able to bring us together and help us work together, realize that we are all at some fundamental level the same, and we can all suffer the same way, and we can all serve in the same way. So I don't think that it would be as terrible, and that it would not allow us to seek like JP thinks. Gary or Jim, what do you guys think?
An event like that might be the way that we end third density and begin fourth. You know, it might look really terrible on the third density side, really good on the fourth density side. Who knows?
I had a thought similar to Jim's in that at least the physical evolutionary record on this planet shows periods of punctuated by mass extinctions with subsequent rapid diversification of species and growth of new species. You see that same principle operating in a forest. Big tree takes up sunlight, not much undergrowth. Tree gets struck by lightning, falls down, dies. And then suddenly there's new sunlight available for the ground and a whole bunch of plants spring up. So the old has to give way for the new to spring forth. Same in an individual's path. Old patterns, old identifications, and so on and so forth. Old personas have to die in order to create room for new. And there's a constant cycle of birth and death. And death and destruction seem to be necessary parts of creation. Indeed, in order to have birth, you need death, or birth doesn't make any sense. But what is being born and what's dying? It's what you might call forms. And the one itself, per se, isn't born, doesn't die, but these forms do. A form rises and a form falls, and that makes it sound impersonal. Because it's not to us. It's very painful to people in the experience, but it seems to make sense in the larger, from the larger viewpoint. And I agree wholeheartedly too with what Austin was saying regarding introducing disharmony into the system. And I always think about, in terms of the pre-veil, post-veil situation, I think back to the Matrix series, and this, of course, isn't a literary equivalent to the actual story of creation, but it's an interesting parallel when Morpheus is imprisoned and I think being interrogated by Agent Smith. Agent Smith is explaining the history of the Matrix to Morpheus, and Smith says that, you know, our original Matrix, we basically created a heaven or a paradise for you humans, but it didn't work. There was no potential created. I forget exactly what Agent Smith says, but for some reason it didn't work. So we had to create one that had disharmony created into it in order to, and it's interesting in the Matrix, that the humans become actual batteries for these negative entities. So Smith says the Matrix was created so that humans would be batteries, which has some interesting parallels, though not equivalency to what the Law of One says about polarity, acting as does sort of creating a difference in potential that then creates work, much like the two poles of a battery. But that's my thoughts.
Your thoughts made me think of the part of the Law of One when Ra says, Why then be concerned with the grass that blooms, withers, and dies in its season, only to grow once again due to the infinite love and light of the one Creator? This is the message
yeah.
you bring. Each entity is only superficially that which blooms and dies. In a deeper sense, there is no end to beingness.
Yeah, exactly.
So that is sort of what JP is asking about, I think, is why does the grass die after it blooms? How can the grass be allowed to die after it blooms? And that's that there is a deeper truth beneath the death and the rebirth of the grass. Anything else to add to JP's question?
I think you guys have knocked it out of the park.
Not from me.
We can go ahead and go to a question from Joy via Facebook, I think. And Joy asks a very good and interesting question. She says, I am interested to know, in Law of One terms, how one may maintain healthy personal boundaries with those in our family, or even outside our inner circle, who consciously or unconsciously impose their will upon us, such as by behaving controlling, criticizing, smothering, or by manipulation, while still remaining positively oriented towards serving others. When is it considered acceptable to remove yourself from living with a loved one who simply won't respect your free will, even though they love you very much? I realize even the most difficult relationships are catalysts, yet is it ever in the interest of the highest good of all involved to walk away or to create some space between yourself and that person, if done with love?
Well, I'll start. I think that it's very much within one's ability to create a boundary, a healthy boundary, which may involve, you know, a heavy boundary. It may involve moving physically away. It may be that this person cannot and does not have it within himself or herself to stop the smothering, the whatever. And the only solution is a physical separation. In that case, what you're doing is you're saying to the Creator, I love this person. I am forever one with this person. I love this person's soul. This person's behavior is hurting me, and I can't handle it. And I need to have a boundary made in order for me to manage to live a manageable, reasonable life. I've tried everything I know how short of this, and I have not been able to succeed. And so reluctantly, I have decided it must be in my best interest, and in a way, in the other person's best interest as well, to create more of a boundary and go ahead and move physically away, as well as mentally and emotionally away. Now, I know that it's possible to live with someone and clothe oneself so completely in indifference, in thinking about other things, you know, whatever, that you just don't hear that person. It's like a small insect nattering at you, and you just don't hear it. You're not respecting that person, but you're enduring that person. Isn't it actually better to create more of a boundary and then to listen when that person has something that he must say? But limit the, you know, amount of time that you'll allow this person to say so, because you're not there. I have never run into such a situation in my life. I was in good shape with my parents and all of my relatives. And even with a person I thought I was going to hate forever, I ended up loving her dearly. And a lot of times you can turn a situation at work around like that. But sometimes you just can't. sometimes you give them an inch, they'll take a mile. Give them another inch, they'll take another mile. And pretty soon there's nothing of you left. And you're just an exhausted, worn-out person because of this person is sucking your vital energy completely away. It can become toxic. It can show up in your physical health. You could become depressed, you know. So you have to watch just exactly what effect this attempt to love everyone has on you, what this attempt to love this person has on you. If nothing is working that, you know, allows you to be close to that person, then I say make a more thick boundary than that and go ahead and move, because that might actually be helping the other person as well. The other person doesn't need you as much as she thinks she does, or he doesn't. You don't need that person's advice as much as that person thinks you do, and so forth. Okay, I'm done. Anybody else?
I agree with you that it is definitely can be in the highest good to create some distance between you and another person if that other person is really affecting your ability to be compassionate. But I think it is a tricky issue. I feel like in order to do this in a positive way, you have to make sure that your communication is very open and honest, and you're very direct with this person about how you feel and how you feel what they are doing is affecting you negatively. And this takes a lot of introspection and asking yourself questions about whether or not you are creating stories in your own head about how this person is affecting you, or if you really do need to create some distance. And so when you tell somebody that if they continue the way that they're acting, then you're going to have to create distance, it isn't much of an ultimatum that is trying to get them to change their behavior. It's more of making sure that you are protected and that you have space to do what you need to do. Because I do think that being inundated in catalyst, especially relationship catalyst like this and family catalyst, it sort of takes away our ability to actually process the catalyst. If it's just constant and we don't have space to ourselves to observe it, and creating more distance between you and a person who is doing this to you can help you observe it a little more, process it, and then maybe once you get away and process the catalyst and think about the situation without being in the middle of it, you can take down some of those boundaries because you now are equipped to handle the type of catalyst that they would normally be handing you and that you would normally experience in that situation. So I think a really big, important aspect is honest communication with yourself and with the other person. Make sure that they know what they're doing is affecting you, and make sure that you are being honest with yourself about how what they're doing is affecting you, and that you aren't attempting to control their behavior by giving them an ultimatum.
Mm-hmm. That's good, yes.
How about you, Jim? Any response to Joy?
I would agree with everything that you and Carla said. My one addition would be that if in the new configuration that doesn't include physically being close to this person, if this kind of a situation occurs again and you find yourself once again being manipulated or smothered or so forth, then you might want to think more about, well, maybe this is a lesson I need to be facing. So I think that's kind of really a fail-safe. I mean, we have free will to do whatever we want, and you can leave a situation that seems harmful, but if it keeps popping up, it might be something we have to look at more carefully.
That's a good point. She says she realizes that relationships are basically our biggest catalyst. So just leaving the situation and trying to forget about it probably isn't doing anybody much good. But if you try to create distance and try to process it, that's probably better than just trying to escape it completely. How about you, Gary?
I think boundaries are necessary and healthy to maintain the integrity of the system. And I also, I hadn't considered Jim's point in my own reply, but concur completely. I think we all need to do self-reflection and find out what our part in any given dynamic is as well. I would say that I wrote a plus and a minus, and then the word relates. I don't know what that means. I was jotting down my thoughts while listening to you guys. I think that love and drawing boundaries are not incompatible. Love and saying no is not incompatible. I think you need to look at your no or look at your boundary and see if it's accompanied with any kind of negative emotion, like judgment or criticism or anger or desire to control, etc. That indicates to me where there's greater work to do, where there is an emotional charge. If your no is not accompanied by negative emotion, but like genuine love for the person, where you say, no, you can't do this, or no, I can't do that, or no, we can't do this, and just feel your heart open and you see them for the perfect expression of the creator that they are, then I think that's closer to a balanced situation whereby you do give a no, but accept the person. That's what positive and minus mean. I think a good resource for exploring this question further is reading Ra's discussion about how the polarities relate, specifically how the positive entity responds to negatively sourced psychic greeting. I think that will yield a lot of fruit in terms of seeing the negative entity as yourself, as the creator, but nevertheless saying, no, sorry, you can't control me, so on and so forth. That's my thought.
I was actually just thinking about that in the dynamic between the positive and negative polarity, and understanding that joy is not necessarily asking about somebody who is of the negative polarity, but somebody who kind of does this either consciously or unconsciously. But there was one part in the raw material, I think it was specifically talking about the negative greeting that Jim, Carla, and Don were getting, and Don asking how they could serve that entity. And to paraphrase, Ra basically said, consider the fact that if you served this entity in this moment how that entity wishes to be served, you would no longer be able to serve in the greater way that you wish to serve. And so I think that's a good way to look at this as well, is that if you try to put yourself in a situation where you're trying to serve this person by being close to them and allowing them to do what they do to you, it might inhibit your ability to serve in greater ways in other parts of your life. Anybody else have anything to add to Joy's question?
Well, I just think that what you said there is really wise, and it, you know, I'm working with a person right now that this is part of his problem, his perceived difficulty, and I'm really glad that we had this discussion because it will help me help him, and I thank you guys for taking the time to really explore, get a few layers deeper into the situation, starting to look at the genuine situation, you know, which is several layers deep, and not sitting on top of it and just taking one's own word or anybody else's word for what's actually happening, but asking yourself these many questions, you know, is this working to create, to co-create some situation that if you left, it would you'd simply go and create it again. Is it really? Let's look at, you know, best interest more carefully, and make sure that it's in your best interest, that you are not telling stories to yourself. Those two things really caught me. And I appreciate what you just said also. Austin. So thank you to you all for that.
And thank you, and thank Joy for the great question.
Yeah, very good question, Joy. Come up with some more. We love it.
Yes.
We may not respond to your gladness, or we may not know enough to help you, but we'll sure try with everything we've got.
We will do our best.
Yeah.
We've got about 9 minutes left, so we might be able to get in JP's second question here. If we happen to go over an hour time, anybody listening live, you can always catch the rest of the show on our archive page. So JP asks, in Book 4, Session 90 of The Law of One, Ra answered a question by saying, it is correct that the Logos designed its experiment to attempt to achieve the greatest possible opportunities for polarization in third density. It is incorrect that warfare of the types specific to your experience was planned by the Logos. And JP asks, does anyone else ever question the notion that maybe we were given too much free will too soon and too early? It goes to show you how much hope and trust they have in us, and that we will somehow muddle through all this someday and survive the madness of war and not destroy our planet or ourselves.
I don't know where it was that I saw this, but I'm pretty sure that I've seen some channeling that they indeed were taken quite aback by this situation that had occurred from the free will, and thought that perhaps this was too much free will. But I can't send anybody to that source because I can't remember where I heard it. Sorry. It's always those things, forward, you know. With every forward, you know, there's another generation of goodbye, you know. You just can't remember exactly where you saw it.
Yeah, I think it's a tricky question because we always have to keep in mind the idea of perfection that Gary was talking about earlier, and that in the light of perfection, things can't really go wrong. You can't have too much free will. But if the goal of the Logos is to efficiently move entities from first density to seventh density, and do so efficiently, then our solar system seems like it may have...
It may do it, yeah.
It might not necessarily be the most efficient, because there was one planet, due to the amount of free will given to us, that destroyed itself completely, according to Ra.
Mm-hmm.
And then another planet which destroyed its ability to support life, according to Ra.
Right.
And Earth is... It looks like we might have a bit of a harvest, but the conditions of our third density have sort of deterred the harvest a bit, and that Ra says that our planet will not have a harvest at the level that it can actually support. Mm. So
it's really too bad. You know, you think about the nature of people, and you watch people get more and more power, and in many cases, sadly but truly, you watch them get more and more bent by their ability to use power. And if you can do anything, then including hit the red button that sends us all into a nuclea wimpa, as Carl Sagan used to say, somebody, sometime, somehow, is going to at least come close to hitting it. Like this North Korea guy, what was his name? He's the head of North Korea. He's very, very young. And
the missing Kim Jong-un?
Could be. He went through a period of liking this one rock band, and then when he saw the lyrics to one of the songs that he disagreed with, he said that it ought to be, that rock band ought to be blown off the face of the earth, and he was going to do it. And, you know, he had the bomb. He could do it. He just had to find out where they all were. And I was thinking, he's the kind of an idiot that has the power. You know, he's the kind of person we have with the button in their hands. And it makes your knees shake. But you have to pull back when you start thinking like that and realize you can't do anything about such things, all you can do is hold that space that believes that all is well, as Gary would say, and as I would say. So I think it's important to keep holding that space. It really is, regardless of what the world looks like on the surface, because it, you know, you go down several layers and it really isn't like that.
Jim, did you have any thoughts on JP's question about free will? How about you, Gary?
Mickey, are you on the phone? Did you have any question about, did you have anything to say about this guy's question on free will? Could we have too much free will?
No, I don't think we can have too much free will. I think everything gets worked out in the end. I mean, like we said before, what looks disastrous here may look totally different from another point of view. Like Ross said, there are no mistakes. There are, however, some surprises.
He says, does anyone ever question the notion that maybe we're given too much free will too soon and too early? I think the Logos definitely could have let humanity keep the training wheels on a little bit longer before they took them off, or maybe like made us earn the opposable thumb through spiritual development.
Well, of course, that comes the whole thing about, you know, how we were supposed at one time to have much longer lifetimes. We were supposed to live longer. We were supposed to have a longer time to grow up. And
good
keep
point.
Our training wheels on, but, you know, we don't, that didn't happen. You know, we started thinking in terms of money instead of sharing, and started making people buy things instead of just say, okay, I've got this and you've got that, let's trade. And they started getting greedy, you know. And it's from those humble beginnings that our short lifetimes happened.
So it's basically the start of capitalism that brought our lifespans down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very evil thing.
Yeah, I forgot all about the long lifespans and that third density entities supposedly had that at the beginning.
Yeah, 900 and some years, wasn't it, Mickey?
Yeah. Like it's mentioned in the Old Testament, I think those are real numbers. 890 years, 912 years people lived.
Yeah, they were telling us how long people lived, and then it started getting real short real fast, but it started out long.
I think one thing to keep in mind when thinking about the potential for destruction that we have in this planetary system is that when you have a potential that goes one way, you create a potential in the other direction. So being able to hold that space that believes that all is well, as Carla and Gary were saying, I think has more power within this environment where the potential for destruction is so great.
Yes.
Any final thoughts?
I always have that one final thought, and that is that we love you all so much.
Yes, we do. You have been listening to LL Research's In the Now, Q&A with Carla and crew. If you've enjoyed the show, please visit our websites, llresearch.org and bringforth.org. Thanks so much for listening, and a special thank you to those who submitted questions. If you'd like to submit a question for us before the next show, please read the instructions on our page at blogtalkradio.com/LLResearch. Have a wonderful week, and be here next week, hopefully. Our schedule's up in the air right now, but if we are here, we will talk with you then. ¶¶